You've had cornflakes for breakfast, haven't you? Of course you have. Everybody has eaten cornflakes at one time or another. And why do you eat cornflakes? Well, sustenance, fiber, the added vitamins, taste, maybe habit. Okay, all that's valid. But none of these things explain why cornflakes exist in the first place. Let me explain. In the late 19th century, there was a very, 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 very big hangout about self-pleasure. Not only was this activity frowned upon from a religious and moral perspective, it was also thought to be bad for you from a physical and emotional point of view. In fact, this sort of touching was not just a weakness, it was an illness that needed medical treatment. Left alone, it was thought that this behavior would lead to all kinds of things. Physical problems, mental problems, acne, heart palpitations, mood swings, bad posture, a fondness for spicy foods. Seriously. Therefore, it needed to stop. John Harvey Kellogg was a doctor from Michigan, and he believed the solitary vice needed to be stomped out. Now, keep in mind that this man did not even like sex to the point where he never consummated his marriage. But anyway, his idea for curing people of the bad touch was a special diet. Meat and certain seasonings were out because they merely increased sexual desire. The best diet, he said, was one featuring plain cereals and nuts. And his first invention was a mixture that he called granola. Yeah. When that proved to be very popular, he came up with several types of breakfast cereals made of flaked grain. And one of these was cornflakes. This led to the establishment of the Kellogg Company, a maker of ready-to-eat breakfast foods guaranteed to stop you from fiddling down there. The Kellogg's cornflakes on the shelf today are the same cornflakes designed to stop, you know. I did not make that up. That's a breakfast cereal secret. Now, some secrets about rock.
This is The Secret History of Rock with Alan Cross.
Hello again, I'm Alan Cross, and this is yet another edition of The Secret History of Rock. Have you noticed that most of the biggest acts in rock and roll today actually predate the 21st century? Now think about it. U2, Green Day, Soundgarden, Pearl Jam, Black Sabbath, Rolling Stones, Springsteen, AC/DC, the unending fascination with Nirvana and Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and the Beatles and Bowie. The roots of all these acts go back to the 90s at minimum, and even as far back as the late 1950s for some. Where are all the superstar acts from this decade, this century, this millennium? Now they do exist, but there's far, far fewer of them than we used to have. Why? Well, we'll tackle that question. Once we're done with that, we'll reach back to 1980 to see what was going on then. And I want to begin with another exploration of the real stories behind big songs. Every song comes with a story. What it means, how it was written, where it was recorded, what inspired it. And sometimes the story is very, very obvious. Other times, not so much. And here's an example of what I mean. Most people will think of U2's I Will Follow as the band's breakthrough single, and it was. But have you ever given any thought as to what the song is actually all about? It begins on September 10th, 1974, when Bono was just 13 years old. That's the day his mother, Iris Houston, gathered the family together and set off for the funeral of her father, Bono's grandfather. Now this was a tough day. Just a few days earlier, Iris and Bono's father, Bob, had celebrated their 25th wedding anniversary at a Dublin hotel, and Iris's dad was there. He had a great time. He was drinking and laughing and dancing, and the old man went to bed happy. But he never woke up. Sometime that night, he died in his sleep. As the oldest child, Iris was put in charge of the funeral arrangements. She was devastated. She did not handle it well. A couple of days later, everybody gathered at the church and then the gravesite for Grandfather Alex's funeral and burial. And it was at the gravesite that Iris fainted. And it wasn't any kind of regular faint either. It was a cerebral hemorrhage, a bad one. She hung on for 4 days in a coma, and when it was clear that there was absolutely no hope, Bono's dad consented to have the life support machines turned off. From that point on, the Houston family consisted of three guys. There was Bob, son Norman, and son Bono, who was, of course, still known as Paul at that point. And remember, he's 13 years old. These events, understandably, had a huge psychological effect on Bono. He became angry and confused. He turned into something of a loner and a weirdo. Wasn't good. But when music entered his life in a proper way in the fall of 1976 with the first rehearsals of what would become U2, he was saved. And this is where we can talk about I Will Follow. The song is rooted in the idea of the unconditional love a mother has for a son. But the song also talks about what happens when a son walks away, or rather is taken away from a mother, as in, if you walk away, I will follow. The song is actually sung from the perspective of his mother's point of view. If you read it a certain way, it almost comes off like a suicide note. And yes, Bono has acknowledged that is a valid interpretation. The thing that really made the song happen, though, was a loud and violent argument between Bono and The Edge during rehearsals. While they were going through the new song, Bono was annoyed at how softly The Edge was playing his parts. And the story is that Bono ripped the guitar away from The Edge and said, "No, you're going to play it this way." You got that? Now listen. U2 and I Will Follow, a song inspired by the sudden death of Bono's mother. Next, let's deconstruct Anarchy in the UK by the Sex Pistols. It's possible that you've heard the song 1,000 times and still don't understand its full meaning. 1970s Britain was not a happy place for a lot of people. The economy was awful. It seemed that everybody was going on strike. There were shortages, there was rationing, and the empire was crumbling. Yet, the British class system was as strong as ever. And it got violent. There's a reason you never find a garbage can on the London tube system, and that's because homegrown terrorists used them as places to plant bombs back then. There were kidnappings. There were assassinations. It really was anarchy or something close to it. But when it comes to the song, we're not just talking about rage and anger towards the divide between rich and poor, young and old, and the whole British class system thing. The song features some unique Britishisms, and they need some translating. The first set of initials that we encounter in the song is the NME. Now, Johnny's not singing about the enemy as in somebody who's against you. He's referring to the New Music Express, the NME, one of the super influential weekly music papers. And what he's saying is that he wants you to use that paper to spread news of his values and philosophy. Then Johnny mentions the MPLA. That's the French acronym for the Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola. See, Angola was big news in the middle 70s, having driven out their Portuguese masters in a bloody revolution, thanks to support from their buddies in the Soviet Union, China, and Cuba. The rebels took over the country by creating anarchy. Johnny also talks about the UDA. That's the Ulster Defense Association, a terrorist group from Northern Ireland dedicated to keeping that part of Ireland under British rule. They rejected unification with the Republic of Ireland by any means necessary. Again, more anarchy. And finally, Johnny name-checks the IRA, the Irish Republican Army. Their sworn goal was to overthrow the government by any means necessary, and they went head-to-head with the UDA. So you see what the song is about, right? Anarchy at home, anarchy abroad. Johnny was just writing about what he read in the newspapers every day.
Because I
Anarchy in the UK from the Sex Pistols. And now that we've decoded it, perhaps the song will have greater meaning for you. Here's one more, and this is actually pretty darn weird. What the hell is Michael Stipe going on about in the song What's the Frequency, Kenneth? By REM. Again, this requires some explanation. October 1986, Dan Rather, anchor for the CBS Evening News, went out for dinner at a friend's house. Afterwards, he's walking down Park Avenue, and two well-dressed men block his path. The tall one with the mustache looked Rather in the eye and asked, Kenneth, what's the frequency? Rather was rather puzzled at this, so he said something to the effect of, sorry, dude, but you got the wrong guy. Before he can step around the guy, Mustache Man takes a roundhouse right at Rather, punching him right in the face. Rather hit the sidewalk, but he quickly got up and he started to run. And these two guys follow, screaming and punching and kicking at him, all while yelling, Kenneth, what's the frequency? Rather only managed to escape being pummeled by ducking into the lobby of an apartment building where the doorman called the cops. The two men on the sidewalk disappeared. They were never seen again. So what was that all about? Well, at one point, the theory was that Rather had been mistaken for a guy named Kenneth Schaefer, an electronics expert who had designed a system for intercepting coded transmissions from Soviet satellites. Pretty good. But it's not true. It wasn't until January 1997 that we learned that Mustache Man's name was William Tager, a mentally ill guy who believed that the media, including Dan Rather and CBS, were beaming satellite signals directly into his head. Guess the tinfoil hat didn't work. Tager was eventually convicted for murdering a technician at NBC on August 31st, 1994. At his trial, his psychologist testified that it was definitely Tager who attacked Rather on Park Avenue in October of 1986. But there's more. Paul Limbert, a writer for Harper's Magazine, stumbled across the writings of a Texas man named Donald Barthelemy. In his fictional stories, Bartholomew often used a character called Kenneth. The phrase, what is the frequency, turned up in these stories too. And there was a character, an evil, unscrupulous newsman named Mr. Lather. Bartholomew worked in journalism and media in Texas in the 50s and early 60s. Dan Rather's from Texas, and he worked in journalism and media in Texas in the 50s and early 60s. Is that a coincidence, or is there something more? What's the frequency, Kenneth? This y'all been so drained. By the way, that song was recorded at a tempo much slower than what was intended. When R.E.M. was in the studio, bass player Mike Mills slowed everything down and the band just kind of followed his lead. But when they were done, everybody looked over at Mike and he didn't look so well. "I have to go to the hospital," he said. Turns out he had appendicitis. And when he recovered, the band never bothered to re-record the song. Cool story, no? Back in a moment with a look at why so few superstar acts have emerged in the 21st century.
Stick around. It's the Secret History of Rock
with Alan Cross.
Exclusively on Sonic 1029. We'll be right back. Now you can take Sonic 1029 anywhere you go. Download the Rogers Radio mobile app for free for your BlackBerry, iPhone, or Android device. Standard data charges apply.
This is the Secret History of Rock.
It's the Secret History of Rock with Alan Cross. Only from Sonic 1029.
You may have noticed that most of the biggest rock acts in the world aren't that young. Check out the average age of groups like Soundgarden and Alice in Chains and Pearl Jam, and you're well into the 40s. Dave Grohl, Trent Reznor, well into their 40s. The average age of U2, low 50s. Same with Bon Jovi. Springsteen, he's in his early 60s. Black Sabbath, middle 60s. Paul McCartney, early 70s. And the Rolling Stones? Well, do you have to ask? Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not one of those people who rag on old rockers just because they're old. That whole rock is for the young BS. If the acts can continue to do what they do well into their pension years, well, you know what? All the power to them. Part of the reason these acts continue to do well is because their body of work is incredibly strong and not dated. Beatles music is still brilliant, even though some of it is five decades old. The other reason these acts still attract attention is because, well, there really hasn't been much of anyone to replace them. Where are all the superstar acts of the 21st century? Oh, they exist, except that there's far, far fewer of them these days. Okay, wait. Perhaps I should clarify by what I mean by superstar. For the purposes of this discussion, I'm going to compare today's music with the achievements and the accomplishments and sales and popularity of rock acts from the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s with what we see today. Again, this is rock. This is not pop. That's a different thing altogether. We're just focusing on rock. So what am I talking about? Well, an act that sells music by the millions and millions of units. I'm talking about concerts by acts for which tens of thousands of people will crawl over broken glass to get tickets. And I'm talking about acts where there's consensus, which is a really important word here, consensus by millions of people that these acts are truly great and worthy of everyone's attention. Now think about that for a few minutes. Why is there no longer the same kind of consensus about which rock bands are truly great, at least compared to what we saw in the 20th century? In other words, why is there a lack of old-school, old-style superstar bands?
Last night, she said, oh, baby, I feel so down. Oh,
Strokes with Last Night from the 2001 debut, Is This It? Critically acclaimed? Most definitely. Well-known? In some circles. Influential? Yes, to some followers. Worthy of magazine covers and features? Sure. Bestsellers? Not really. On only two occasions has one of their albums reached the number one spot on a national album chart. Once in the UK and once in Australia. Can they fill an arena or a stadium on their own? Probably not. This is not a put-down of the Strokes. They are a very fine band and were instrumental in revitalizing rock at a time when it looked like the world was going to drown in the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC. But compare them in overall stature to a Pearl Jam or a Bon Jovi, and they fall very short. Okay, what about Arcade Fire? Juno Awards, Polaris Music Prize Award, Grammy Award, Brit Award. They are easily one of the most acclaimed bands of the last dozen years. Magazine covers, blogger coverage, an excellent concert draw. That's a heck of a dream resume, but when compared to the superstar acts of the past, how do they stack up? Well, to tell the truth, a little anemic. For all the accolades and positions atop best-of lists, Arcade Fire hasn't sold that many records. Their first album, Funeral, is sitting somewhere around sales of a million copies. That's worldwide. Their second, Neon Bible, has yet to be declared gold in the United States, meaning sales are less than half a million. And the suburbs? Probably around 1.4 million worldwide. And that's after winning all those awards, including a Grammy and a Brit. Okay. So maybe I'm going about this all wrong. We can't measure superstar-ness in terms of album sales anymore. After all, nobody is buying records in the numbers that they used to in the days before the internet. Not even U2 can think of selling 20 million copies of an album ever again. It's just not going to happen. A better example might be the place an act has in the public's consciousness. Can we measure that somehow? Let's try with this example. Back in the 1970s, if there were 30 people in a grade 10 class, three kids would be country fans, seven would be into the pop music of the day, and the other 20 would be Kiss fans. They were Kiss fans because everywhere they went, someone would tell them that Kiss was the biggest and the best band in the world. They heard it on the radio from their favorite DJ. They read it in magazines. They saw it whenever they went into a record store. They heard it from their older brothers and sisters. Everything reinforced this impression that Kiss was the best. Consensus. But this was in an era when access to music was tightly controlled by record labels and radio and printed media. They were the filters, only letting through certain music which they curated on our behalf, and often to their benefit. There were, in short, fewer acts for the general public to choose from, which made it easier for an ordinary fan to pick a favorite. And it made it easier for the musical powers that be to manufacture consensus, there's that word again, on which band were worth your time and money. Now, this isn't to say that people were manipulated into liking crap, although that was a big part of the strategy. It was, however, a time when it was easier to join a musical tribe of some sort that liked a specific band. Today, though, the traditional gatekeepers of those days are gone. With the internet, the power lies with the individual music fan. You are free to pursue whatever musical interests you have, and nothing can get in your way. Consensus? You are in charge. Who needs it? You are your own A&R man, your own music director, editor, and curator. You don't need anyone to tell you what to listen to. And if it turns out that there are others like you, well, that's okay. It's nice, but not necessary.
Never made it as a wise man. I couldn't cut it as a poor man stealing. Tired of living like a blind man. I'm sick of sight without a sense of feeling, and this is how you remind me. This is how you remind me of what I really am. This is how you remind me. So bad, 'cause living with me must have damn near killed you, and this is how you remind me of what I really am. This is how you remind me. Never made it as a wise man. I couldn't cut it as a poor man stealing. And this is how you remind me. This is how you remind me. This is how you remind me of what I really am. This is.
Now, there's a band that, whether you want to believe it or not, has emerged as a genuine superstar act of the 21st century. Nickelback's How You Remind Me was played on the radio more times than any other song, repeat, any other song, between 2001 and 2009. Billboard slotted that as the fourth biggest song of the first decade of the 21st century. And while it is true that Nickelback was formed in the 90s, they really didn't break through until the Silver Side Up album of 2001. That record has sold more than 800,000 copies just in Canada. It sold more than 900,000 copies in the UK, more than 2 million in Europe, and more than 6 million in the United States. Worldwide, the number is about 10 million, which is pretty damn close to those old school superstar numbers. And when Nickelback goes on tour, they sell out every single show. A tour can gross $100 million. So you can love them or hate them, but you have to include Nickelback as one of the few superstar rock acts to emerge this century. And they're not alone. You've probably been trying to make a list in your head of which acts qualify for what I'm talking about here. Let's find out if you're right. Back in a second.
Stick around. We'll be right back with more of the secret history of rock with Alan Cross. Right here on Sonic 102.9. Download the Rogers Radio mobile app totally for free in your friendly neighborhood Android, BlackBerry, or iPhone app store. Standard data charges apply.
Back to the secret history of rock.
Welcome back to the secret history of rock with Alan Cross. Right here on Sonic 102.9.
Welcome back. We're trying to explain why we haven't seen that many superstar rock acts to come out of the 21st century. Going back to previous decades, there used to be a lot more, or at least so it seemed. The answer seems to be that consumer choice is now unlimited and unfettered. We make the choices when it comes to what we listen to and who we like. And with all that individual power, there's more disagreement. Or, I guess more correctly, less agreement on which acts should receive our time, attention, and money. In other words, the public's attention has been spread thinner and thinner and thinner. Yes, Arcade Fire and the Strokes do get a lot of attention, but that hasn't translated into the kind of music sales and concert attendance that we used to see with the biggest bands of the day back in the day. But this doesn't mean that there still aren't instances of mass consensus that looks a lot like the old days. Here's another one of my picks for a genuine superstar act from the past 10 years or so. And it might surprise you.
Laughing gas, these hazmats, little tired. Shit, I'm stepping in harder this year. Yeah, been rapping in harder this year. Watch me as I gravitate. Ha, 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 ha. We gon' ghost town, this Motown. With your sound, you in the blink. Gon' bite the dust, can't fight with us. With your sound, you kill the ink. So don't stop, get it until you chin it.
Gorillaz, the virtual band created by Blur's Damon Albarn and cartoonist Jamie Hewlett. They were conceived in 1998, and they released a debut album in 2001 that sold, wait for it, more than 10 million copies worldwide. It was followed by Demon Days in 2005. That one sold more than 6 million around the world. And the last proper studio record? Not so much. Plastic Beach hit number one in countries all over the globe when it was released in 2010, but just like everyone else, Gorillaz suffered a huge decline in sales. We're looking at about a million for Plastic Beach, which still isn't bad, but it's less than 10% of that first record. Mind you, the argument could be made that Gorillaz had just gone beyond their best before date and they expired like any band will over time. And being a virtual group, it was difficult for the band to tour properly for much of their existence, which could have impacted things. Another band that has to be on this list is Linkin Park. Since they started releasing albums in 2000, they have sold over 50 million records worldwide. Their first album, Hybrid Theory, is the only rock album of the 21st century to earn a Diamond Award for sales of 10 million copies or more in the U.S. Actually, Hybrid Theory is more than double Diamond. When I checked, U.S. sales have totaled in the neighborhood of 24 million copies. To put that achievement into perspective, Hybrid Theory is in about the same league as U2's The Joshua Tree, which is at 25 million, and Legend, the greatest hits collection by Bob Marley, also about 25 million. Meteora, their second album, is around 11 million units. Their third, Minutes to Midnight, is around 6 million. Albums 4 and 5 have sold less, but again, that's more about the state of record sales in general than anything else. But Linkin Park can still headline their own tour and sell tens of thousands of concert tickets. And when a new record comes out, it's a really big deal. And they still get tons of radio airplay. So by any measure, Linkin Park has achieved widespread consensus and therefore qualifies as a 21st century superstar band.
It starts with
one thing. I don't know why. It doesn't even matter how hard you try. Keep that in mind. I designed this rhyme to explain in due time. All I know, time is a valuable thing. Watch it fly by as the pendulum swings. Watch it count down to the end of the day. The clock ticks life away. It's so unreal. Didn't look out below. Watch the time go right out the window. Trying to hold on to, didn't even know. I wasted it all just to watch you go. I kept everything inside, and even though I tried, it all fell apart. What it meant to be will eventually be a memory of a time I tried so hard and got so far.
I had to fall to lose it all. But I designed this rhyme to remind myself how I tried so hard. In spite of the way you were mocking me, acting like I was part of your property, remembering all the times you fought with me, I'm surprised it got so things aren't the way they were before. You wouldn't even recognize me anymore. Not that you knew me back then, but it all comes back to me in the end. You kept everything inside, and even though I tried, it all fell apart. What it meant to me will eventually be a memory of a time when I tried so hard.
No questions there. Linkin Park makes our list of genuine modern-day superstar bands, which is to say that they achieved their superstarness in the 21st century. Very difficult thing. I don't think anybody's going to dispute it if I call Jack White a superstar act. He's a very interesting animal. Now, none of the bands he's been associated with have sold superstar levels of records. Not the White Stripes, not the Rack on Tours, not the Dead Weather, and not Jack White as a solo artist. The White Stripes did manage to play some bigger venues. I saw them in a mid-sized arena a couple of times. But beyond that, Jack's gigs have been in smaller soft-seaters, or large clubs, or as part of a festival. But Jack himself is everywhere. Everybody knows his name. He's acted in Hollywood films. He's written scores for Oscar-winning movies. He runs his own record label. He's a performer. He's a producer. He's a collaborator with everyone from Alicia Keys and Loretta Lynn to Insane Clown Posse, to The Edge, to Jimmy Page, to Bob Dylan. He's also worked with Danger Mouse and Norah Jones and Beck and Jeff Beck, Conan O'Brien and Stephen Colbert. The biggest selling record that Jack has appeared on is probably the White Stripes' 2003 album Elephant. It has worldwide sales of somewhere around 6 million. But like I said, Jack's a different cat. He really can't be judged by traditional metrics. If you're a rock fan, if you're a blues fan, if you're an indie fan, a country fan, or a sports fan, you at least have some idea of what a big deal Jack White is.
Talking to myself at night because I can't forget.
Seven Nation Army from Jack White, Meg White, the White Stripes. That riff, which isn't a bass, by the way, but a guitar run through an effects pedal, is used at sporting events around the world. It's especially immense in Italy. That song was used as an anthem for Italy's 2006 World Cup run and was used both for Euro 2008 and Euro 2012. It's also been claimed by football clubs in Belgium and Scotland and Liverpool and Melbourne. The Mexican Soccer League uses it. More than a half a dozen American college football teams. The Baltimore Ravens. The New York Knicks. Superstar stuff. So let's review our list of acts that we can qualify as genuine 20th century superstars, albeit with a slightly, you know, skewed set of measurements. We have Jack White, Linkin Park, Gorillaz, Nickelback, Arcade Fire, and The Strokes. Who else needs to be on this list? Well, I can think of at least three others, and we'll tackle them next.
Stick around. We'll be right back with more of the secret history of rock with Alan Cross on Sonic 1029. We'll be right back.
Text us Sonic Style.
1-0-0-2-9.
Text us Sonic Style.
This is CHDI Edmonton.
Back to the secret history of rock
with Alan Cross, exclusively on Sonic 1029.
We're trying to determine which rock acts that have emerged in the 21st century can be considered to be genuine superstar acts using more or less the same sorts of metrics that we used to apply back in the last millennium. We have to include Muse on this list. Although they got a late start in North America, they were huge in the UK, Europe, and Japan for years. I remember sitting with the band in the middle of a sushi restaurant in downtown Toronto a number of years ago, and leader Matt Bellamy had this weird expression on his face. He says, what's wrong, Matt? And I asked him. And he said, nothing. It's just that it's a little weird for us that we can sit in the middle of this restaurant in a big city and not attract any attention. Well, those days are done. The best estimate I can find for Muse record sales is a global figure of about 15 million. Their last album, The Second Law, reached number one in 11 countries around the planet and number two in seven others. But that really doesn't capture their immense popularity as a live act. This is a group that can, on their own, sell out Wembley Stadium in London. They can easily headline a tour anywhere in the world and fill arenas. However you want to measure it, Muse has become one of the biggest rock bands in the world. And they've accomplished it all, mostly since 2001.
I can't get these memories out of my mind. And some kind of madness has started to I tried so hard to let you go, but some kind of madness is swallowing me whole. Yeah. Yeah.
Madness, Muse, and The Second Law. I don't have any trouble including the Killers on this list of 21st century superstar acts. They've sold at least 60 million records worldwide, and like Muse, they can headline a tour of arenas without really breaking that much of a sweat. In fact, the Killers' rise was so quick that they went from playing tiny clubs to filling outdoor amphitheaters within just the lifetime of their debut album, Hot Fuss. The Killers are also particularly buzzworthy for the press. They're one of those groups who inspire lots of cover stories and feature stories, even between albums. They're especially big in the UK, where that debut record spent 173 weeks on the album charts. And I was just going through a list of awards that the band has received. You know that part of the band's career has its own Wikipedia page? Grammy nominations, Brit nominations, American Music Awards, International Dance Music Awards, MT Music Video Awards, Much Music Awards. This list goes on and on and on and on. So they sold a decent number of records. They're a big concert draw. New songs are instant addition to radio station playlists, and they've won a lot of awards. Next to most of the rock bands who have launched their careers in the 21st century, I would say that you could probably call the Killers superstars. One more act that I think qualifies as a genuine 21st century superstar band. Now remember, we're talking about bands that achieved critical mass for the first time this century. And while Green Day and Pearl Jam and U2 and Soundgarden and Nine Inch Nails and a ton of others continue to be superstars, all of them had their original breakthroughs in the last century. So who's left here? Gotta be Coldplay. They played their very first show on January 16th, 1998. There were a couple of EPs that were mostly ignored. But then came the Parachutes album on July 10th of 2000. It stunned everyone, including the band. by selling more than 9 million copies worldwide and netting the band a Grammy for Best Alternative Music Album. Rush of Blood to the Head, which came 25 months later, was a huge leap creatively and stylistically, selling more than 15 million copies. X and Y from 2005 did almost as well, moving 13 million. Viva La Vida, released in June of 2008 when the music industry was crashing, managed to sell 10 million copies. And even Milo Zalato, which came out on October 19th, 2011, has sold 8 million. Worldwide sales for Coldplay are now somewhere well beyond 60 million records. And this has all happened since July of 2000. They can headline anything they want, including the biggest music festivals. They've got a truckload of awards. News of whether they had a new album coming on time or not affected the stock of their record company. And the singer is married to a Hollywood movie star, for God's sake. Old school superstar attributes, regardless of which decade you want to measure things against. Anybody want to argue? Anyone? I didn't think so. So there's our list of what I consider to be the genuine superstar rock acts of the 21st century. New acts that made their name this century and not in the last one. The Strokes, Arcade Fire, Nickelback, Gorillaz, Linkin Park, Jack White, Muse, The Killers, and Coldplay. Missed anyone? Let me know. Back in a sec with a look at the music of 1980.
Stick around. It's the secret history of rock.
With Alan Cross.
Exclusively on Sonic 1029. We'll be right back. Wherever, whenever, anytime, any place. Modern rock along to Sonic 1029 with the Rogers Radio mobile app. Download it now. Totally free and on your Android, iPhone, or BlackBerry device. Standard data charges apply.
Back to the Secret History of Rock.
Welcome back to the Secret History of Rock with Alan Cross, right here on Sonic 102.9.
This week we're going to dig into the crates for what everybody was listening to in 1980, which was a really weird time. It was the tail end of the disco era. Punk had pretty much burned itself out and morphed into new wave. The debut of MTV in the music video era was still a year away. And the introduction of the CD was still more than 2 years off. And there was a brutal recession. Now, forget about it being just a difficult time for music. It was a difficult time for people, period. But audiences found things to turn to, some of which came from the unlikeliest of places, like New Zealand. Split Enz started as a weird art rock pop vaudeville punk sort of thing with these weird costumes and makeup. But by the time they got to their fifth album, they were, well, much more conventional looking. I remember there was a gimmick with their True Colors album. If you looked at the vinyl, you'd see all kinds of shapes and angles that reflected in the light in odd ways. They called this laser etching, and it was the first album in the world to use this technology. It was supposed to be used for identifying counterfeit records, but for some reason it never caught on. Here's the breakthrough single from that album, Split Enz and I Got You.
I got you. That's all I want. I won't forget. That's a whole lot. I don't go out. Not now that you're in. Sometimes we shout. But that's no problem.
Is the Secret History of Rock with Alan Cross.
Generals and majors are all that ever too far from battlefields.
XTC and Generals and Majors from their fourth album, Black Sea. At the time, they were signed to Virgin Records, and if you remember the video, yes, that was label boss Richard Branson. And XTC was still touring at the time. It wasn't until April of 82 that singer Andy Partridge's stage fright got the best of him, and the band never played live again. 1980 was when goth culture really began to get organized. There had been flirtations with this dark, theatrical sort of thing for a couple of years, but it took until Bauhaus released their debut single, Bela Lugosi's Dead, for things to start taking shape. Susie and the Banshees were part of this goth community, at least they were back then. Their third album was called Kaleidoscope, and for the first time they got into drum machines and synthesizers. Not a lot, but enough to give them a fresh sound. This song is a good example. It was inspired by a real person, Christine Cosner Sizemore, the woman with multiple personalities who was also the inspiration for the movie The Three Faces of Eve. Two of Christine's personalities are mentioned in this song, the Banana Split Lady and the Strawberry Girl. If you have the vinyl 7-inch, the B-side features a song called Eve White, Eve Black, and those were two more of Christine's identities. Susie and the Banshees with Christine.
Is The Secret History of Rock with Alan Cross.
Thinking comic book violence and escaping steam. Gray-suited businessmen hissing against a wall, that's a crumbling guardrail. Slow motion car fall. Tokyo.
Tokyo from Bruce Cockburn. His 1980 album, his 11th studio record, was called Humans. And that was the first album where he really began to get more political with his writing, an approach that would peak a couple of years later with songs like If I Had a Rocket Launcher. So there's a sampling of what was big in 1980. We'll figure out what to do about another year in 1 week. Finally, some useless information. We're going to poke through that in just a sec.
Stick around. We'll be right back with more of the secret history of rock with Alan Cross. Right here on Sonic 1029. Sonic 1029 harvests the newest crop of modern rock, then plants the tunes on the airwaves. It's Farm Fresh, Sonic's new music show. Sunday nights at 8 and Tuesday nights at 11, where songs grow before they're in the know. Farm Fresh on Sonic 1029. Welcome back to the secret history of rock with Alan Cross, exclusively on Sonic 1029.
A lot of people have told me that they really like this last segment where I dump just a bunch of information on the table. This is all stuff that I've learned in the past week that I have nowhere to put. But information needs to be free, so I provide it to you in hopes that it will be of some use. So I call this segment Useless Information because it is, for the moment, useless to me. Maybe you will do better. If you're a guy and you want a tip that might help you attract more ladies to your Facebook site, replace your profile picture with one of you holding a guitar. A serious scientific study indicates that a Facebook picture featuring a guy holding a guitar will yield up to 28% more positive results for a flirtatious message than one that doesn't come with you holding a guitar. I don't make this stuff up. Another story. Inmates at Guantanamo Bay were tortured with music from Sesame Street. I quote from a report from a human rights researcher. Prisoners were forced to put on headphones. They were attached to chairs, headphones attached to their heads, and they were left alone with just the music for very long periods of time, sometimes hours, even days on end, listening to repeated loud Sesame Street music. The music was so loud, said a former detainee, and it was some of the worst torture they faced. Speaking of difficult things to listen to, back in the 1990s, all teachers in North Korea were required to be able to play the accordion. If you wanted to get your teaching certificate in North Korea, you also had to pass an accordion test. And I'm just going to play the song that David Bowie released on his 66th birthday, January 8th, 2013. I'm going to do this in honor of the fact that he managed to keep the existence of a new album secret for 2 whole years. It's incredible.
Had to get the train from Potsdamer Platz. You never knew that I could do that. Just walking the day. Sitting in the jungle under the stars, a man lost in time near Cardiff, just walking the dead. Thousand people, Crosbers and Booker, fingers are crossed just in case, walking the dead.
Secret History of Rock with Alan Cross on Sonic 1029. We'll be right back. The tops in modern rock wrapped up in a nice 20-song package.
Hosted by me, Rick Lee.
It's the Modern Rock Countdown.
Where your favorite tracks fight it out to be crowned number one.
Weekends on Edmonton's source for modern rock.
Sonic 1029. Welcome back to the Secret History of Rock with Alan Cross. Exclusively on Sonic 1029.
And that's all I've got for this episode, but I will be back in another week with more information about music that you never knew you needed to know. But it's fun, right? Knowledge is power, and music knowledge is a great way to impress your friends and enemies. If you need more of that kind of stuff, try the website, thesecrethistoryofrock.com. You'll get stuff just like you've been listening to for the last couple of hours every single day. And you can also sign up for a newsletter that will deliver 10 cool music stories to your inbox every single day at around 10 a.m. Eastern. You should get it, trust me. TheSecretHistoryOfRock.com. Also, watch for me on Twitter and Facebook. And should you have the occasion to send me an email, I will write back. Talk to you next time. I'm Alan Cross.
Thanks for listening to The Secret History of Rock with Alan Cross.
The Secret History of Rock.
This is CHDI Edmonton. Sonic 1029.